Good. So many people. Very nice. No, it's, I really mean that. I've had lectures with less audience. So, let's do it. Yes, obviously, what we left off with yesterday was we were trying to, well, investigate real-world network in terms of several statistics that would allow us to get an overview over them. And, well, let's do it, okay? So, first thing that we need to take into consideration is how long does it take from one end to the network to another? Okay, so, or in other words, what is the mean average path length in that network? Okay, so we know that from a node A to a node B, there is a shortest path, and we can do statistics about those shortest paths. And what we would want is that the length of the, or the diameter of the graph, or I should say, no, it's not the diameter, it's the mean average path length. Okay, good. So you take statistics, you compute all the distances from node I to node J, right? Not twice, that's why we're having this summation index here. And then you set this into proportion to the number of pairs, taking the pairs from I to I also into account, right? And this then obviously gives the mean average path length. So the D, I, J are the shortest paths between path lengths between I and J. Now, what would we like to have, or what's a setting in which we give this a special name? And if this quantity as a function of n goes as logarithm of n, then we would call this a small world, okay? So it doesn't take much to get from one node to another, or in other words, everyone knows everyone else over very few edges, right? So if we take, for example, Facebook with an order of magnitude of 10 to the 9, we would have O of 9 in this case, right? Or very few, very small numbers, okay? And as we've seen in the Milgram experiment, it turned out that the world's population is connected by as many as 6, or as few as 6, right? Now, this is something that we find desirable in many cases, because shortest paths are something that you would want, okay? If we have several components in our network, if it falls apart into disjoint subnetworks with no edges between them, obviously we have a lot of distances which are infinity or infinite. So what we can do in this case is we can switch from the normal mean, as in this case, to the harmonic mean. And why I'm not doing a proper presentation is, I don't know. Now it's the proper presentation. Very nice. Good. And that's the one we will investigate. Now, what we will see is that it's not difficult at all to construct networks that have a small mean average path length. So that's something that's easy to achieve, surprisingly so, even with comparatively few edges. Okay. We will see that there are other quantities which are harder to get when we're doing simulations and constructing networks. Now, another thing that we would like to investigate is the clustering coefficient, okay? So there's two versions of the clustering coefficient, and these are what? You don't know? Don't want to know? No? Okay, good. Then not. So, first clustering coefficient, so what is the purpose of clustering coefficients? So they, as the name suggests, they suggest how well clustered the network is, okay? How well it is coherent and falls into clusters, right? And the first version would do statistics over triangles and connected triples. Okay, so a triangle obviously is something like this, and a connected triple would be something like this. Okay, and we can see that each triangle contains three different connected triples. So that's why in a perfectly clustered graph, which would be what? A clique, right? So if the whole graph is a clique, what would we get? We would like to have a clustering coefficient of 1. In order to do that, we must multiply the number of triangles with 3 in order to counterbalance the fact that each triangle contains 3 of those triples. Or we could say that the number of triangles needs to be set into proportion to the number of paths of length 2, right? So this is a path of length 2, yeah? And since this can be in 2 flavors, we have to be a 6 here, right? So this is just a version, depends on how you want to compute it. Now, in essence, what this is the friend of a friend probability. How probable is it that 2 of your friends are also friends? Okay? This is more or less what this is. And we will see that this plays a role when we talk about random networks, right? Another version is done in a different way. So here, what we have is basically the ratio of means, right? So you compute 2 quantities, you add them up, and you build the ratio. Now here, what we will compute in this version is the mean of ratios, right? So here we would go about defining a clustering coefficient for a single node, right? And the single node's ego network would be like that. And you could ask yourself exactly again, what's the probability that 2 of your friends are also connected? And you could do statistics about that to be more precise. And then you count the number of triples with the node I as the center, and then you count the number of times that these triples are closed, right? So that they form a triangle, and set this into proportion. Now, this is just the number of edges in your ego network divided by your degree times degree minus 1 over half. So how many pairs are within your friend network, okay? And then, obviously, you would have, if you have want to compute this for the whole graph, you would have to compute an average over all these quantities for each node, right? And this is called, for good reason, the Watt-Strogatz version, because we will look at this from the perspective of their Nature paper from 1998. Good. So, as an example, to see why they're different, so if we have this network here, right, the first clustering coefficient is comparatively easy to compute, so we have to compute the number of triangles. That's easy because there's only 1 triangle. And then we have to count the number of connected triples, right? And then here's one, there's one, there's one, there are several in here. And if you count them properly, you will see that there are 8 of those, right? Which results in a index or a coefficient of 0.375. Whereas if we compute the other things, we would need to compute the individual clustering coefficients, right? So for example, if we take this node here, this node has 2 friends, right? And the number of triples is equal to the number of triangles. Yes. So in this case, for this node, the clustering coefficient would be 1. Yes. Sure. Yeah. So for the first case here, you mean this 8, you would have to count 1 triple, 2 triples, 3 triples, right? And the same is here, right? So the clustering coefficient for this node would be a 1 for this node as well. And for this node, what we would have is, so there are obviously 4 triples centered at this node, but only 1 triangle, right? Or no, it's even 6, right? If you count them properly, right? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and one triangle. So the clustering coefficient of this individual node would be 1/6. And if you do the proper statistics, what you get is 0.413. Yeah. And these are two versions of basically the same story, just numerically different. Good. So what's the evidence? We said that, okay, for the mean average path length, what we would, or what we see in many networks is a logarithmic connection between the number of nodes and the mean average path length. Now here, what we see is that the clustering coefficient in many real world networks is constant as n goes to infinity, right? So it's around the order of magnitude of, let's say, 0.05 or 0.2 or something. Yeah. And so that doesn't depend on n, which is an interesting finding. And what this tells us is that we're having groups on all levels of size, right? So society tends to fall apart into a hierarchy of such groups. If it were that the number of groups or the size of groups would be strictly limited, then we wouldn't find that, because if n really goes to infinity, the clustering coefficient should go down with n. Yeah, because let's say we had only families and nothing else but families, right? Then the members between families wouldn't be clustered at all, right? So it's only clustering within the families. Such if the society then goes to infinity, the clustering would also go to infinity. But what we see is we have sports clubs, families, communities, cities, countries. We have all kinds of hierarchical things, clusters. So the whole thing is constant. The downside is that if you compute a random network, and we will see what this is, you would see that the clustering coefficients, both versions, would go as 1 over n, right? So they would disappear. And this means that there is something characteristic going on, which tended to puzzle people until 1998 when the Watt-Strogatz model came out. So it's seemingly simple. Construct a random graph model where both things are actually present, a small mean average path length and a small clustering coefficient. But obviously this is not so easy. Yeah? And we'll see how we can do that. Now this is a slide that you would probably not be able to read in detail, but just here for the overview. So there's several kinds of networks here with their respective statistical quantities that we will investigate. Here are social networks, information networks, technological networks, and biological networks. And here we have the stuff where the Kevin Bacon number stems from, so film actors with co-acting relations between them, co-authorships in various disciplines, telephone calls, and stuff like that, right? Student relationships, whatever. And here it's denoted whether it's a directed or undirected network, the number of nodes, the number of edges, and you can already see that these are comparatively large, right? So this telephone call graph has already 47 million nodes, which is a lot, and it has about 80 million edges. But what we see at the same time is that the number of edges is not really quadratic in the number of nodes here. So these are comparatively sparse networks. Now, Z is the mean degree, right? So as for Facebook, you would find something in the order of magnitude of around 100 or 150, which tells you that the Facebook friendship network is not actually only comprised of people that you meet on a regular basis, because that number would be fewer for most people. But the number of friends in terms of even loose friends, but typically you know that 200, 300, that's what people have, right? And the co-acting is in the same order of magnitude, right? L is the mean average path length. And we'll already see that within Hollywood, it is a small world, right? So everybody acted with everybody else. Why these numbers are not here for this network, I don't know. Maybe because it's an American paper. Okay, good. So alpha is a coefficient that we will get later. So that's about the degree distribution. And yesterday we already said that one characteristic is that the degree distribution goes as k to the minus alpha. Okay, and the question is, if we're having such a power law distribution, then the question is, what is alpha? These are the two clustering coefficients, and R is a correlation, Pearson correlation, of the actual degrees of the nodes, right? And this will measure effects as do the rich or are rich people always connected with rich people? Or are super socializers as a tendency connected with other super socializers and nerds with nerds, right? The question is what's happening here? And this will be the thing later on in the lecture, right? Good. So that's that. And here are the references in the paper, right? So as we see, the clustering coefficients are comparatively large here, right? Even 0.6, 0.8, right? Whereas in other networks, such as these technological networks, they're one or two orders of magnitude smaller, okay? And we will see that they're even smaller for random networks. And here what we see, for example, is that the internet as a technological network of computers with surprisingly few nodes, which is just obviously just a cut out and not the whole story, is comparable, right? So we're also having a small world here if you want to go from one router to another. We will get back to this slide later on. Now, speaking of the degree distribution, right? So the notation will be, what's the probability of a node having degree k, or denoted by p small k. This is the probability, or in other words, the fraction of nodes having a degree k. Now, as with all probability distributions, and that's a discrete probability function, what we can compute is the cumulative distribution, right? So what's the probability of having larger than or including k or larger many friends, yeah? And this is denoted with a large p, as always, right? So what you would normally have in probability theory is that if you have some probability, discrete probability distribution of whatever sort, right, and you denote k, and this is small pk, what you would normally use as a cumulative distribution is you would sum up from minus infinity to a certain point, right? And you would take all of this into consideration and then call this large pk, right? What we've done here is just the opposite. We would sum from here to infinity, and it's natural that you would get our version is then just 1 minus the other version. Okay, so that's nothing mysterious. Now, if we have a power law, so if you do an integration on a function like that, what you would get is that you would have to raise the exponent by 1. So that's usual with power law terms. Because at the differentiation, you would have to lower the exponent, and integrating, you would have to add 1, okay? Now, this is rather straightforward. If we are having an exponential distribution here, so the power law, we will later see on the slide, goes also down, but the exponential goes down much faster. What we get is integrating the exponential here would yield the exponential back, right? Notwithstanding the constant coefficients that would arise, okay? So, and this is characteristic because the power law changes slightly under integration while the exponential doesn't. So if we look at these things, so this is a normal lot of power loss, so k to the minus 2. Yeah? So that would be something like this. If alpha is 1, you would have a normal hyperbola, and depending on the exponent, it would go down faster the higher this exponent here is, the absolute value, right? And what's a very typical way of plotting this is either a logarithmic plot where the y-axis is scaled logarithmically, or it's a, if you plot it in a double logarithmic coordinate system, you would get this, okay? So why is this the case? So obviously if this is logarithmized and this is logarithmized, and if we're talking about something to the power minus alpha, right? So the minus dictates whether this goes down or up. This is not a big thing, and the alpha controls the slope. But if we plot two things logarithmically, then we get strictly a straight line. Okay, and this is the characteristic for the power law. And if you plot real world networks, you would plot them in a doubly logarithmic coordinate system and watch out whether there is a straight line. Now, for the exponential function, things seemingly look very alike, at least in the normal plot. Here it is the case that if you plot it on a singly logarithmic scale, you would get a straight line, obviously, because that's e to the power something. Yeah. Now, if you do that doubly logarithmic, what you get is a curve that points down. And this is interesting, because if we look at real-world networks, what we see is that in many cases, there is something like a slight drop-off, right? So if you play around with GNUplot or other plotting or MATLAB, you would see that you can get these slightly aberrated distributions by mixtures, right? So you maybe have a setting where the main part is a power law, but for very small degrees or very large degrees, the network shows something like a slightly different behavior. Yeah, and that's natural, right? In case of Facebook, it is the case that we also have a power law, yes, but for very large numbers of friends, things drop very fast because there's only very few Justin Biebers around there, right? Even fewer than you would expect from the power law. And what we see is that, for example, the citation network is not truly a power law, right? Here in these regions, we might suspect something like that, but it is actually not. Same as for scientific collaborations, right? So this would be more like an exponential drop-off. However, many of them are actually power laws, and we will see why this is of significance, right? So and a term that you would find is often that power law networks are called scale-free, or scale-free, I should say. And why is this? So there is two ways of viewing this. So the first one is, what does it mean to be scale-free? It means that no matter which granularity you look at things or which measurement scale you have, the function in question still looks the same, right? And this means that we would like, if we have a scaling factor of A, we would like to have the function unchanged in that scaling x with a results just in scaling the y-axis with b, right? So this is a formulation of being scale-free, yeah? Meaning that it doesn't matter which scale I use. And the power law is actually the only solution to this functional equation, okay? Another point of view is that if we're actually having a power law with a negative exponent, the expectation is something that we can compute. Yeah? But what we cannot compute, or which a quantity that diverges, is the variance. Right? So this is normal statistical empirical variance of this distribution, and this quantity just diverges. And usually you would use the variance to plot something like error bars. Okay? So the variance is typically something that is used to quantify how unsure you are about your measurements, right? And if you're totally unsure, this corresponds to we just cannot be sure in that sense. So there is no characteristic scale, and that's why we call it scale-free. It's a bit more indirect, that argumentation, right? I would probably prefer this one. Let's just explain the terminology why power law networks are called scale-free. Well, what are typical power law networks? Well, the web, the internet, telephone call network, social networks of various kinds, and what are exponential networks? Well, the power grid, so in speaking of renewable energy and the corresponding problems, you'd have to be aware of this, traffic networks, and so on. And power laws with exponential cutoffs are, for example, this movie co-actor network, right? While, and this is maybe clear from an organizational point of view, whereas in Facebook, the exponential drop-off might be much more mild, because it is possible for Justin Bieber to have 500 trillion gazillion teenagers as friends. Yeah, so it's just an act of data. In real world networks where you would have to pay actors, it's clear you cannot have 500,000 actors in a movie, right? This is simply out of range. And even, so what's the main cast of a Hollywood movie? I don't know, 20, 30, and the support cast would be like 100, 150, but then it's basically over. And that's because movies are 90 minutes typically, and they're not 15 hours. If they were 15 hours, it would be different, right? So in Games of Thrones, you'd have potentially like 500-600 support actors. But even then, there's a natural limit to these artifacts, right? You won't never find an HBO series that would last 5,000 hours. Just won't happen. Has a lot to do with culture and so on. So the power law exponential cutoff is rather strict in these cases. Yeah? Good. These were just two or three things that we saw. Mean average path length, clustering coefficient, and degree distribution. And they're all, well, descriptive quantities that would not take into account individual nodes. It would just be a characterization of the whole network as it is. Another thing that we might be interested in is what's the maximum degree, right? And I'll show you this in order to show you typical ways of how people in those papers do computations, right? So you can estimate things, right? One way to estimate the maximum degree is that you say there should be less or equal one node with this maximum degree, right? And so the computing this expectation here, so n is the number of nodes. If we compute the probability, you just remember pk is the distribution of the nodes over the degrees k, right? So we could ask, what's the probability of having a degree k max, right? And multiply this with n, and this should be 1, right? So this is like computing this expectation-like quantity. And for a power law, we would see if pk goes as k to the minus alpha, we can just solve for k max and find that k max goes as n to the 1 over alpha. Okay? So it depends on how fast this decrease is. And if it's faster, then the maximum degree is smaller, obviously, right? And if it's less strict for n to infinity, the maximum degree that we can expect is something more akin to that, right? And this is the normal way to compute, here in this case, this expectation-like quantity. However, that's not very accurate. So let's be a bit more accurate, right? Now, obviously, the probability, and this should be reading here as P equal, and this is just that expression here, the probability of having exactly M nodes that have a degree of K, and all the rest of the other nodes has a smaller degree, what's that probability, right? So we know that PK denotes the probability of a node having degree K, right? So we're having M nodes with degree K, so we'll have to take PK to the power M, and all the rest of the nodes shall be smaller. That means the rest of the nodes, so that's N minus those M, has a smaller degree, meaning 1 minus PK, yeah? Large PK. Because all the others have something smaller, and that already contains summing up the probabilities for all those smaller degrees. And this is just the combinatorial correction. So how many possibilities do we have to pick M nodes out of N? Right? So that's something binomial-like, right? Not exactly, but something like that structure. So the probability of K being the highest degree in the graph, right? What must we do? We must take into account all variations of M, right? So it could be the case that we're having one node with K and the rest smaller, two nodes with K and the rest smaller, 500 and the rest smaller. So we have to sum M equal to 1 up to N. Yeah? These are all the possible cases for M, right? And this is just the resulting expression, and we call this HK, right? Now, this is a formula that we know how to evaluate, and that's if you recall the binomial formula, if you have something like A plus B to the power N, right? What's that? So that would be something like M equal to 1 to N, and we have N over M, A to the M, and B, N minus M. Yeah? So that's the binomial formula. And in this case, no, sorry, you might have recognized the error, M equal to 0 to N. Right? This is the binomial formula, right? Because the leading terms are obviously A to the N, so that would mean M, or B to the N, which means M equal to 0. So this is certainly a term B to the N that we need, right? So we would have to start with M from 0. Now, if you compare this, the only difference is that we're starting from 1, right? So we have to subtract the term for M equal to 0, and that's just this 1 minus large PK to the N, right? So this is the reason why we subtract this. And then we're just left with A plus B to the power N, right? A is PK, B is 1 minus large PK, right? And that's basically it. So this is the probability of K being the highest degree in the graph. Now, the expected highest degree, we would have to compute the expectation, meaning we would have to sum over all possibilities for K, right? What's the possibility of 15 being the highest degree? Well, that's H15. And we'd have to compute the expectation. So that's K max as we would find here. And you would just have to do this numerically or analytically, however you want. We'll see that the result is surprisingly similar to what we have here with our very simple estimation above, right? So in order to evaluate these things, what we can do is, obviously, let's go back here. Obviously, this is something that you can plot, right, as well as the PK. And what you find is that this HK is small for small k and also for large k. So it looks something like this, right? Or should be something like this potentially, right? So what we can do is if we want to compute the expectation of a distribution like that, right, we can just take the the mode, right? So the mode is the x where the distribution takes its extremal value, okay? And, well, we can replace this sum here by just this modal value, right? So expectation would be, well, multiplying with, yeah, let's call this k. Multiplying with k and summing it up. And for k max, you could also use this mode, mean or mode. It's always the question what you would like to have. In order to compute that, well, set the derivative equal to zero. And what we need is that the derivative of the cumulative distribution is just the distribution itself. Okay, that's simple as always. Now, if we compute the derivative here with respect to k, right, what we have to insert is our knowledge for pk. In case of a power law, that's k to minus alpha, and large pk is k to the minus alpha plus 1 or minus alpha minus 1. And, well, that's the result. Okay, and that should be zero. So using this and simplifying, we find that k max is a solution of this, well, differential equation. And, well, we arrive at this simplification assuming that pk is small for k larger than k max, which it somehow should fall off quickly. Otherwise, our estimation for k max wouldn't be valid, right? If it does, if it continues like that, this is certainly not a good estimation for k max. So if the pk for larger k's should be small, and the expected n times pk should be small against 1 as well as this for these quantities, right? And if you insert this, or if you, well, insert your formula for pk, we would simply be able to solve that and find that k max is, again, n to the 1 over, and now the corrected coefficient here is alpha minus 1, right? So for this simple estimation, we would get n to the 1 minus alpha, 1 over alpha, and here we would get n to the 1 over alpha minus 1, right? This is just to show you how many of the computations are made, and it's not very, very dramatic, right? Good. Now, that was the maximum degree, right? So if you're interested in social networks, you could try to be interested in things as what's the maximum number of friends that people have in that network. Now, another quantity that's interesting in order to describe the nature and structure of a network is how resilient is it with respect to destroying nodes or edges, right? If you machine gun the network, will it fall apart or not? And that's called network resilience. The question is, what happens if nodes are removed? And as it's written already, this can have, or you could be interested in network resilience from a perspective of avoiding attacks, but you could also be interested in that if you really want to destroy a network in terms of disease spreading networks with measures of vaccination, right? Because you want to know if a vaccination campaign will likely be effective. Yeah? And this is in times of Ebola, this is a clear application, right? Because people in Uganda and Sierra Leone and so on, would really be interested in those epidemiological forecasts, obviously, right? Now, for power law networks, what we find is if we remove randomly nodes, so here on the x-axis we have the fraction of vertices removed, and on the y-axis, we have the mean vertex distance, so the mean average path length in effect, right? And what we see is that targeting random nodes almost has no effect at all, right? So you can eliminate a lot of nodes before something will happen. And the red curve is different because in the red curve, what you do is you deliberately target high degree nodes, right? So you sniper out the persons with the most friends, yeah, one by one. And this has a drastic effect, right? Because the mean average path length really goes up. And even if we only shoot the most popular 2% of the population, we would find that this has a drastic effect on the Osama bin Laden effect, right? So this would kind of destroy these properties. And well, the question is, so the internet itself has a power law distribution, at least roughly so. And well, is the internet now easy to attack or not so easy to attack? And there's several argumentations that interpret these results, right? So one says, well, it's obviously not easy to attack because if you just randomly shoot down servers, it won't do anything, or routers, right? And the other one says, well, yes, if you happen to really be able to shoot down the high degree nodes, okay, then the network will also go down. Depends on your perspective. However, since the power law is in effect, there are only very few of those high degree routers, comparatively few. So depends on your perspective, on your level of desired security that you would like to have. Okay. Good. So that's network resilience, and we'll get back to this later when we look at percolation models for disease spreading, right? Another very, very important term and a very important characteristic is what mixing pattern does the network exhibit, okay? Now, obviously, what is mixing? So mixing is only possible if your set of nodes falls apart into disjoint classes, right? And you would be interesting whether there are significantly more edges between those classes than within. And this somehow smells like graph clustering, and we will see, yes, it has something to do with that, right? There are two terms, right, that are in effect here. First one is assortative mixing, and we would call the network assortatively mixed or homophily in place if nodes have the tendency to attach to similar nodes, right? So there are more edges within the sorts than between the sorts. And obviously the other possibility is disassortative mixing, where nodes attach to nodes of different classes, right? Good. So what do we have? So disassortative network are, for example, in action where we would model food webs in ecology, right? So lions don't eat lions, right? And zebras don't eat zebras, right? Zebras eat grass and lions eat zebras, right? So this is a clear disassortative mixing pattern. And the web is hierarchical, right? So the big backbone providers are linked among themselves, right? Or not that much among themselves, but they are linked. However, they are typically linked to the internet service providers, and those are linked to the end users. And the end users are typically not linked among themselves, at least not excessively so, right? And if you regard the topology of our network, you would find the same hierarchy here. So we'd have disassortative mixing. And not surprisingly, in social networks, we have assortativity, right? And that's kind of a problem. And a few weeks ago, there was an article in Der Spiegel about chances in life, right? And the argumentation was that in Germany, chances are not, or the society is not as transparent with respect to going up in terms of social status as other societies, because in Germany the rich tend to stay among themselves, so the poor don't have a real chance of prospering, right? Or as arrogant people say, poverty stinks. Yeah, so this is just a way of explaining this. And this is something that you would not want in your society, right? So you would want to have at least a random mixing. That would be something desirable, I'd say, right? Now let's look at an example and let's look at quantities to measure this. So this is a matrix that shows us mixing patterns among races or a subpopulation of the U.S. Population. And, well, we have blacks, we have whites, we have Hispanics, we have others. So these days I think that Asians would be another quantity here that should be listed. And the question is, well, if I'm a black woman, what's the probability of marrying a Hispanic man, right? Black woman, Hispanic man, low probability, right? Whereas if I'm a black woman, it's very much more probable that I'd be married to a black man, right? And we can already see that this matrix has strong entries on the diagonal, but not so strong entries on the off diagonal. And there's all kinds of cliches in there, right? So if I'm an Hispanic man, then I would potentially like, for whatever reasons, and this is again some racial issue which needs to be counteracted, I would prefer Hispanic women before black. I don't know why. And that's something that we just find. That's just a measurement. Okay. And the question is, what can we do in terms of measures? And one possibility could be, what's the probability if I'm a man of sort J, given that my woman is of sort I, or vice versa? Yeah. So P of J given I. Obviously, if what you need to compute is you need to take the number in question and divide it by the sum over the whole row, right? And this is what you would always do in terms of computing conditional probabilities, right? So what's the probability that I'm woman of sort J, given that my husband is black and of sort I, right? Or one. And then, well, I would say if I'm a Hispanic woman, what's the conditional probability of being Hispanic as a woman, given that the man is black? Well, that's 32 over 506 plus 32 plus 69 plus 26, right? This is just that. And if we sum over the whole matrix E, we get 1. And in order to do that, we need to normalize the matrix. Right, so we need to divide by this matrix norm, which is just the sum of all entries in this case. So that's a simple version of matrix norm. And obviously, if we sum over the first argument, then even the conditional probabilities are probabilities. So that means that they must sum to 1. And that's the case in this case. Now, this matrix E should be kind of familiar to you. So who has ever seen something like this? Who and what's it? Where did you see it? Remember? Sorry? GED, right? Could be something like this. And we had it here in the lecture as well, when we talked about modularity clustering, right? Because that's exactly the same construction. Now, in modularity, you would also, and these then would be the clusters, and E would be the matrix in question, right? So this should come familiar, because that's exactly the formula for modularity. But first, let's construct another measure of assortativity. So that would be this measure Q, where we would say, what's the probability of marrying in your own class, right, and sum this up over all diagonal elements, minus 1, and compare it to n minus 1, where large n is the number of sorts, right? And in this case, we have 4, right? Now, if we would have perfect assortativity, this number would be 1, obviously, because then we would only have blacks marrying blacks and whites marrying whites and Hispanics marrying Hispanics and no mingling, right? And this is, in this case, what would be not desirable as a society, right? Because we would like to be would persons to mix freely irrespective of their race, right? And this is one thing. However, when computing this quantity, this seems to be perfectly symmetric, right? But if we look at the previous slide, it is not symmetric with respect to changing I and J, right? Because here you would have to sum over the rows, whereas if you would change, you would have to sum over the columns. And we see that the matrix itself is not symmetric, right? So it matters if the man is white, and then the consequences for the race of the woman are different than if the woman is Hispanic, right? So it's not a symmetric matrix. And that's why the whole measure is not symmetric. And the other thing is, since here we're only taking into account probabilities, what we don't have is we don't respect the size of classes, right? So in a society which is predominantly black, let's say, and there is a large assortative mixing within the black population, but all these other people that are very few in number mix disassortatively, the whole matrix would still be assortative, but not in the measure Q, because each group is treated on equal footing, not taking into account the actual numbers in their sizes, because here we would divide, right? Now, a second measure is, as we said, the assortativity, which is again what we have, so the trace of E, this matrix E here, right, compared, so this is the actual intra-cluster coherence compared to the intra-cluster coherence of a random network with degree-preserving construction, right? If you want, look that up in the respective slide set, and that's just the normalization that we have there, okay? Okay. One thing that you can investigate here is if you partition the nodes in terms of their degrees, right? And the question then would be, are nodes typically attached to other nodes of the same degree, or are they attached to nodes of different degree, right? And that's, again, the question of popular people meeting popular people, okay? And, what you can do is you can come up with various ways of computing the degree correlation, right? So, if we are investigating the mean degree of neighbors of nodes with degree K, right? If we have assortative mixing, if you plot that, the curve should be increasing, right? And what we find on the web that the curve actually decreases. So that's just one way of graphically determining the assortativity pattern. What you can also do, you can compute the linear Pearson correlation for the node degrees of two adjacent nodes, right? So for all the nodes, let's say we have 100 nodes in the graph. So you have 100 pairs of numbers, right? And so the first number is the degree of the first node, and the second number is the degree of the second node, right? And what we saw yesterday when talking about Gaussian mixture models is that if the numbers, so that's the degree of node 1, and that's the degree of node 2, if these things are distributed like that, they have a perfect linear correlation, right? And if they are distributed like that, they are perfectly uncorrelated, right? So if K1 changes, K2 is totally unimpressed by this, right? And this would be typically assortative mixing. Yeah. So the Pearson correlation just measures, and that's the off diagonal element of the covariance matrix. So this one here, yeah, with the X. This just measures the degree of linear correlation between those two quantities. A word of caution, because if you're having a relation that goes like this, so seemingly something parabola shaped, then the Pearson correlation can also be very small because it only measures the amount of linear correlation, right? And that's something you have to keep in mind. So there are other measures like Spearman's that also work for these other cases. Good. So that's again this thing here with the mixing patterns, and we already see that R is the Pearson correlation coefficient of the degrees, and we see that for social networks, it tends to be slightly the case, right, that popular actors act with other popular actors, or in other words, Hollywood is a place for one-hit wonders, right? So there are a lot of actors that only have one or two movies, and they would also act with others, whereas Sandra Bullock is much more likely to act with Brad Pitt and George Clooney, right? But however, this is only a very slight correlation. So typically, if you interpret Pearson correlation coefficients, the conservative point of view is that if the Pearson correlation is larger than 0.5, you would accept something as correlated, right? And normally, if you a weak correlation would only be accepted by, let's say, larger than 0.25. Yeah, so 0.2 is a borderline case, I would say. Yeah? Here in this case, for the physics co-authorship, we can much more accept this, right? Because we're having a Pearson correlation of 0.36, right? Almost 0.4. So that means that, well, popular authors, no, not popular, authors, so physicists that have a lot of papers cite other physicists or co-author paper with other physicists, I should say, that also have a lot of papers, right? So the superstars cooperate and the sea of physics losers cooperates only with physics losers, right? And here, if the numbers are negative, the only thing what this means is that we can also have negative correlations, which means that they are perfectly linearly correlated, but not positively, but negatively. But that's not a big issue, right? Okay, and here in the technological case, we see that there is almost no correlation of whatever sort, right? So here, train routes, power grids, numbers are very small, typically. Good. Now, another thing that's discussed in Newman's survey paper, what about the community structure, right? And this we've already talked about extensively in graph clustering. So if you compute a dendrogram of the whole graph with, for example, single link or something, or modularity-based clustering, then you'd get an idea of what the cluster structure is actually like. And here we see another racially based example from the U.S. So the friendship network in a U.S. school. And this is already laid out with something that's called a force-based layout approach. Okay, and I'll expect this in a second. What we see is that obviously there are large clusters and they are racially coherent, right? So that means that whites stick to whites and blacks stick to blacks, and the few Hispanics and Asians are kind of equally distributed in that network, right? So speaking of Chinese Guanxi, they should also be clustered in some sense. But, well, the question is, how is that layout computed, right? So you know that you can compute a graph in several ways, and this can be really misleading. So, for example, if I have a graph that just looks like this, right, such a square-shaped graph, if I draw it like this, you don't see any clusters, right? But I could as well draw it like this, which would suggest the eye something like a clustering, could be, right? But naturally, the graph is exactly the same, right? So what I'm saying is that it depends on how you draw a graph, what actually your perception of clustering is. So we need to find a way to draw graphs in such a way that the eye is not misled, but that the visual system that we have can actually be used as a clustering algorithm, right? And this is done with force-based layouts, and the idea is that if you would introduce springs between the nodes, right, these springs should have forces which should be proportional to the weight of the edge, okay? If all the weights are the same, such as here, where just friendship or no friendship is denoted, well, let them have unit strength, okay? And what you would do is you would introduce those springs between all those edges, crumble it together, spring it up in the air, and let physics do the work, right? Because then an equilibrium should result, where nodes that are very tightly connected by a number of springs should really stick together, whereas nodes that are not as tightly connected should be far apart, right? And so what you also need for this being far apart is you need repulsive forces that would repel the nodes, and with these springs you'd have both, right? So if you draw them apart, they would be attractive, and if you push them together, they would be repulsive, okay? And you can introduce a lot of other forces that would make the drawing nicer, but that's basically it. So you numerically solve for this coupled system of oscillators, and then you get something like this, which should in most cases reveal the clustering structure in an okay way, right? But that only works for comparatively few nodes, right? Good. That's that. So we already discussed this a lot, so we'll skip this. Another thing which is interesting is how navigatable is the network, right? So we know that if the mean average path length is small, there are a lot of short paths. But the question is, can we always find them? Remember the Osama bin Laden example. So you know there was a 25 million reward, and I keep on telling the joke for, I don't know, 3 years, just before his death also. And so your degree of 4 to Osama wasn't of use. My degree of 3 wasn't of use either, because the link that was hard to navigate by was, well, I know my best friend, but I don't know if she knows her colleague from New York, and even less likely this girl knows her uncle in terms of can reach her uncle. She knows him potentially, right? But the question is always, can I find such a path? And if I have the path, can I use it? Now, can I use it is a sociological thing, yeah? So if she knows her and has her telephone number, that's not a matter of graphs, right? In the realm of graphs, the question is solely, I know that there must be a small path, let's say to Vladimir Putin, right? I know that there must be a path of length, let's say 6 or 7 or something in that order of magnitude, but I have no idea which of you to ask. I don't know. Perhaps some of you are from Russia or somewhere else. Maybe that's a good idea to ask him or her, but I don't know. And that's the question, can we find the paths? Now, the Milgram experiment, if you remember that, just showed that there are these short paths, and at the same time, it showed how people would try to navigate in those networks and try to find their ways. And what we saw in Milgram was that people would normally route on the basis of geography. So if I know someone at the East Coast, I will forward the letter and the package to this person, no matter what this person actually does. We will see that there are other ways of making these routing decisions. For example, with respect to profession, yeah, would I rather post it to a lawyer at the West Coast, which potentially knows a lawyer at the East Coast? So that's counterintuitive with respect to geography, but intuitive with respect to ontological routing, right? Now, we will discuss this in length in the upcoming part on social networks in time and space, right? So this is not lost, but will be extensively discussed. And actually, you will check for certain routing properties of your network here in the class if you do the exercise, right? And so this would be, you would able to see how you can find paths to other colleagues here in that network. More interesting than that is the question of, does the graph exhibit a giant component, meaning is the network comprised of a singly connected component, or does it fall apart into disjoint components? And that's interesting if you compute quantities such as centralities or others. Desperation. And because if the graph is already falling apart into components, you would have to take other measures than if you can be very sure that this is not the case, right? Now, question is, does a giant component exist? Well, we'll find out. Before we find out, let's take a deeper look at what did I mean with random graph, right? So I spoke of the question whether a network has a small mean average path length compared to a random version of it, or whether a network has a large clustering coefficient compared to a random version of it. So random version of a graph could mean it has the same number of nodes and roughly the same number of edges, but randomly distributed in some fashion. And the simplest random graph model that you can imagine is the Poisson random graph model. Now, GNP denotes a possible ensemble of graphs with n nodes and a selection probability p, or an instantiation probability p, for each edge, right? So what you do is you lay out n nodes and decide for each pair whether it's connected with an edge with a probability p, right? So they are order of magnitude n squared such edges, and each of them is in the graph with a probability p or not, or 1 minus p not, right? Good. If you ask yourself, if you do that construction, what's the resulting degree distribution? And we'll see that what the degree distribution we know is the probability that some node has degree k. Well, if I'm a node, then and my probability of having exactly k neighbors is the selection probability to the power k, and 1 minus the selection property to the power n minus k, right? So k of my potential edges are in existence, and each one with a probability of p, and n minus k edges are, sorry, you didn't get that edge, right, in that random selection process. And again, we're having a binomial combinatorial correction, n over k, yeah? So this is just the number of ways I can pick my k neighbors from the n. And this is pk. Now, that's a binomial distribution. And we know that if we keep the mean degree z fixed. So that is P times N, roughly. This is just the expectation of the binomial distribution. It's P times N minus 1. It's the expected degree Z. Yeah? If we keep that fixed and let N go to infinity, we can approximate this binomial distribution by a Poisson distribution. And the Poisson distribution is exactly Z to the K, and Z is P times N minus 1, e to the minus Z over K faculty. And, well, what does that look like? So if we denote K, and here we have the Poisson, it typically looks like this, okay? So we're having some maximum, yeah, so the mode would be somewhere here. Sorry, the mode is always the maximum, but the expected value would be slightly shifted to the right because that has this tail here. Yeah? So that's a Poisson distribution, and for large N, this discrete probability distribution, which the binomial actually is, yeah, would take that form, right? So this discrete binomial distribution is approximated by this continuous Poisson. Okay, and that's why these things are called Poisson random graphs. Now, why is that not so nice? Well, in most cases, we're having power law networks. And we've seen that k to the minus alpha, this kind of looks like this. And that's different from that, right? So here we see that we have something like a typical mode value where this is concentrated about, and here we don't have such a thing, yeah? No mode. Good. Another thing we're interested in is, well, we can compute those random graphs, nice, and they would have overall properties exactly as the real-world networks have. And what we would like to do is we would like to compare the properties of our real-world network with its random counterpart. And the question is, what does it mean to say that a given random graph has some property Q, right? And the property Q can be something like it is connected or has a diameter of some sort or whatever, right? Well, GNP, such an ensemble with N nodes and a selection probability P, has a property with high probability if the probability of having that property given N and P goes to 1 if N goes to infinity. So that means we're always regarding the limit of N going to infinity, okay? Because it's if we're having networks with very few edges and very few nodes, there can always be some phenomenon occurring, but that's not what we would expect on average. And on average means that in the limit for large N, these things have certain properties. Now, that's that. And there's a second thing which is very interesting. These properties, Q, often develop in a non-continuous fashion if you go with N or you let N grow, right? And these things might be called phase transitions. So in physics, a phase transition occurs if a system of statistical physics exhibits one sort of behavior in a parameter range X and a disjointly different behavior in a parameter setting X bar or X prime, right? One typical example is ice melting, right? So you know that water has different phases. That's a solid phase, a liquid phase, and a gaseous phase. And there is disjoint points in temperature where such a phase transition occurs, right? You know, 0 Celsius and 100 Celsius. These are the points of phase transition, but only if you keep the pressure the same, right? If you only change the temperature, that means that, for example, if you're having P, the volume, and the temperature, right? So this is the setting of parameters, right? And if you keep P and V fixed, you know that there is phase transitions at 0 and 100 Celsius, meaning that the system's properties change in a non-continuous fashion, right? So ice remains ice, however deeper down you cool it. There's nothing that basically changes. But if you just go from -4 to +7, it would change from ice to liquid. And we're having the same type of non-continuous behaviors in statistical graph systems, meaning that for some property, there exists a threshold function Q. And obviously, you need to have Q going to infinity if n goes to infinity. Otherwise, it wouldn't be a true threshold, such that this probability of having the property Q is zero if we're having this limit relation, and is one if we're having this limit relation, right? So P of n, right? So the probability here, this probability P has to go down. So we started with a constant edge picking probability, okay? But if we want to keep the mean degree fixed, which is n times p, right, then we need to go down with p if n goes to infinity. Otherwise, the network would be changed in structure, right? So if we want to keep the mean degree, we would have a p going down, right? And, if this is the case, if p wins, then the property is actually zero probable. And if Q wins, or let's say this is Q winning and this is P winning, right, so to speak. And this is something that we will see when we investigate the giant component. Okay, good. Now, let's do that. So once again here, one question was, is there a single component or does the network fall apart into different subcomponents? Let's investigate this. And this is just another way of computing that is so typical here, right? Now, if we denote by U the fraction of nodes that do not belong to the giant component that we assume to be there, what this is that U is the probability of a given node to be not in X, okay? That is the fraction of nodes that are not in X, right? Now, if I'm asking for the probability of a given node with a fixed degree K to be not in X, this is equal to the probability that none of its neighbors are in X, because if one of the neighbor is in the giant component, then I'm also part of the giant component. So I must be sure that all my friends do not belong to the component. That's the only case where we can be a separate family that's not connected to the outer world, right? Now, if U is the fraction of nodes that do not belong to the giant component, this probability of me being not in the component, meaning that none of my neighbors, is just U to the power K. Because I'm a node with an assumed degree K. And that means that you don't have to be in the component, you don't have to be, and you, my friend, also, and none of you, right? And that's why we'd have to multiply all these probabilities, right? So multiplying a probability corresponds to logical AND, and adding a probability corresponds to logical OR, right? And here we need to have none of my friends may be in the component. Otherwise, I'm also automatically in there and all my friends also. Now, U for a fixed k is obviously equal to u to the power k. Now, u for a non-fixed k must be computed as the, well, expectation-like quantity if you want, right? So we'd have to go with k from 0 to infinity, and we know that the degree distribution is pk, right? So now we have pk times u to the power k. And what we also know is that for a fixed mean degree, pk is binomially distributed in case of g and p, which can be approximated by a Poisson distribution. And that's what we had here, right? So the exact probability distribution for g and p is binomial, and we can approximate this with this Poisson. And if we do so, what happens is that this u to the k can be drawn together with the z to the power k of the Poisson. And here, again, we will find the power series for the exponential function. So that means, since this is exactly e to the z u, what we get is, as a total, is e to the z u times e to the minus z, right? So that is e to the z u, this series here. Good. Now, that is the probability for a given node to be not in X. Okay. Now, the fraction of the graph that is occupied by X is just 1 minus u. Okay, and if we transform this, S is equal to 1 minus e to the minus z large s. Now, that here, right, so u is equal to e to the z u minus 1. So that's a functional equation for this function u. And you could just turn it into a functional equation for s. Okay, now, this is obviously not so easy to solve. You can and must do that numerically. And that's the result, okay? Now here on the x-axis, we're having the mean degree z, okay? And on the y-axis, we're having two functions. So s, which is the result of this functional equation, is this dotted line here, okay? And that is the size of the giant component, okay? Because going back, fraction of the graph that is occupied by the giant component. So if there is only one giant component, meaning that almost all of the graph is connected, large S must be close to 1. And if there are a lot of disjoint components, S would be small, right? And the second curve here, the solid curve, is the mean size of the smaller rest components, and that's given by this equation. And if you're interested in why this is the case, read it in the paper. Here we won't discuss that, right? So, and this here is a typical shape of a phase transition going on, right? So there's some sort of control parameter that has a that goes to infinity at this point of the phase transition, while the other quantities would quickly rise, right? So this is like ice melting, right? So here you have ice, here you have liquid, and very quickly so, right? So you only have a small temperature in this case. Well, it's not a totally valid example, because if you take a temperature of plus 1 degree and wait long enough, all of the ice will have melted. However, in this case, we see that if we just go slightly above a mean degree of 1, right, which is very moderate, then very quickly we'd have a giant component. So what this says is that it doesn't take much for a social network to be connected. Well, because everyone has at least one friend. So if you're having a network of totally psychopaths, Yeah, then it must be, can be the case that it falls into psychopath components, right? But if you're having normal people with a normal number of friends, it's extremely unlikely that a social network will fall apart into components, right? Nevertheless, if you're regarding socio-technical systems, you obviously have a cold start problem. So if you join Facebook, then you have zero friends. But very quickly so, people tend to pile up numbers of friends. And the measure, if you would just do statistics and compute social computing data sets, then you would have to filter out people that are new, right? So filter out people that have less than two friends, and you can be pretty sure that the rest would be one component, right? And, well, so if the average degree, mean average degree, is only slightly larger than one, we can get a quick phase transition of that sort, right? Well, nice. Good. So, that's basically that for the moment. Next time, we'll continue this. We'll talk about disease spreading. We'll talk about why the rich get richer, and all these mechanisms, right? That's next Tuesday. So see you then next Tuesday.